and shouted down.
They call themselves the African Music Experience. I would really much rather know that young lady's name. Good job on Above All. We heard from Larnell Harris all year long, and it's now 9:30 after the hour on a Wednesday morning. And, of course, that means none other than Doug Greenwald, who's just dropped into the studio from Columbia, Maryland. Doug is with Preserving Bible Times. He's a senior teaching fellow there and the executive director. And we treasure our time together with Doug just about every Wednesday morning. Doug, good morning. Welcome to you.
Good morning, guys. And, you know, I've been listening for the last hour or so, and I really do appreciate how you set the stage for my upcoming weekend.
Your upcoming weekend?
You played Shrimp Boats Are Coming.
Uh-huh.
Ooh.
And you, 10 minutes before that, you had something that closely approximated a Dixieland band.
Oh, yeah. That was the Baja Marimba Band, kind of like that.
And I am off to New Orleans as of tomorrow morning to speak there this weekend on Advent and Christmas in context. And you nicely set the stage. I used to live there in the mid-60s.
Did you? Actually, I didn't know that.
It's a little bit of a quasi homecoming. Nancy and I were married in the mid 60s, and we honeymooned in Louisiana, in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. So we're going to go back to some of the old restaurants we remember.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, it's the same dust is there, all on the things that they hang from the ceiling. I remember are those restaurants in the French Quarter, by the way, or are they in a classier section of town?
They're on Royale Street.
Okay, uh-huh. All right.
Well, the Court of the Two Sisters. It's one of our favorites.
I've been there, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I remember. We're going to try to get into Broussard's, which is on the western end of the quarter.
Fancy schmancy.
We're going to, because our passion in the 60s was tracking down and photographing plantation homes, antebellum plantation homes. Oh. We're going to go see three or four of them that have changed quite a bit in the last 45 years. They're now been restored, and they're restaurants and B&Bs and all fancy stuff like that. But, yeah, we're just going to go back and reminisce as part of our time of bringing Advent and Christmas in context to the New Orleans area.
And, you know, I never report on Louisiana weather. I wonder why I don't ever do that. I'm going to find a silly town name in Louisiana and add it to my silly town name list.
But I they've never got them. Natchitoches would be one.
Yeah, Natchitoches. Okay.
Yeah.
That'd be a good one. All righty.
Opelousas.
Oh, well, I'm sure there's plenty of them there. The thing is, when you go looking for silly place names on the internet, and then you add them to your weather page, they might be listed as a silly place name, but somewhere along the line, they changed their name to a reasonable, like Smith, Louisiana, when it used to be something really colorful. And I think I think that's the effect of the post office people. They don't want silly names. So they do. We still have a few silly names around, though, and I'll find one in Louisiana, add it to the list. I will. Well, we wish you good travel down there and nice warm weather. Hope it'll be nice for you.
Well, it's projected to be pretty much low 70s the whole several days we're going to be there.
That'll
so that sounds good to us right now.
All right.
Oh, yeah.
Now,
sounds good to me.
Your most recent reflection is out, Doug, on Advent. Now, you've been on the air with us now for 3+ years. We're going on 4 years. And we've had your Advent presentations from a Hebrew perspective. And I'm thinking, now that you've been to Italy a couple of times, and you've immersed us in the cultural context of the Roman Empire in Paul's day in the first century, I'll bet there's a twist in that relationship between the Nativity or the Advent season and the culture of the surrounding area.
Well, you're setting a high bar for my ability to connect the dots here. Mm-hmm. But let's go up to 30,000 feet and look down on several centuries. Let's start our time when Malachi ends. And remember that to the observant Jewish mind of the Bible, God is what God does. These Jewish people are not philosophical, unlike the Greeks. They're not conceptual, unlike the Greeks. They're behavioral. And God is what God does. And that's a very helpful way to actually read the Old Testament. The Jewish mind, you know, doesn't think thoughts like omnipresent, omniscient. That's philosophical, conceptual framework stuff. They just know that God is their deliverer because he's delivered them. He's their sustainer because he has sustained them. God is what God does. And so for the 400 plus years from the end of Malachi to the first century, just prior to the birth of Jesus, God has not done anything to the Jewish worldview perspective. There have been no prophets. There have been no deliverance miracles. If we go back through what we know as the intertestamental period of time, we've got Alexander the Great in 332 BC conquering this land of milk and honey, bringing with it Greek philosophy, Greek worldview, life view of hedonism, bringing the Greek language into the land. The Jews know the crisis that that created in Judaism from about 200 BC down to about 170 BC as young men, young Jewish men, bailed out of the traditional Hebrew faith in droves to embrace a superior thought system, Greek philosophy. It created a crisis in Judaism. Who was going to carry on the covenantal faith of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? That gave birth to the Pharisaic movement in its day in roughly the 170 BC time frame to call the Jewish young men back to the covenantal faith of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So a lot went on, but the land certainly seemed to get compromised from an ethical, moral perspective if you're an observant Jew. And then things in 63 BC got even worse. Rome conquered what was left of that part of the world, and now the whole eastern part of the Mediterranean basin is under Roman control. To an observant Jew, Rome is the kingdom of evil. The emperor is Satan himself. Anyone who works for Rome are in the minion, the legions of Satan's domain. And where has God been? Why hasn't God spoken? Why hasn't God done anything? And so you have this 400-year interval from ground level, if you're a Jew, and you just wonder, has God forgotten his people? How do we explain this? Why has God been so silent? Have you ever thought about the intertestamental period of time from the perspective of an observant Jew?
Yeah, but I don't have a lot of information to go by. You know, certainly it's not in the Bible. You got to find other sources for it. I learned a little bit about Alexander the Great and the sweeping changes he made through that entire part of the world. Really, starting from Babylon, the Jewish history changed. It was a sea change. A few remnant people came back to Jerusalem. They tried to rebuild the temple. They did in a manner of speaking. But are pretty well ignored by history from that point on.
Yeah, and I think it's a period in history that most Western evangelicals are fairly not conversant in as well. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. Very seldom have you heard anyone go explain intertestamental history.
Well, there were no prophets from that period. I mean, it's kind of surprising.
No, but it's certainly that what happened in the intertestamental period certainly set the stage for Jesus, and that's why I think it's really important. But anyway, let's go back up to 30,000 feet, and let's try to adopt heaven's perspective here and realize that even though for 400 years at ground level, from the perspective of an observant Jew, God seems to have removed himself, seems to be incredibly silent. Nevertheless, God was at work. His redemptive plan for history continued to unfold in an unimpeded manner throughout that 400 years. He had the fullness of time always in view. And to set the stage for that fullness of time, certain things needed to be in place. For example, a language was going to be needed that could capture the full dimensions as well as the nuances of Jesus' actions, Jesus' deeds, and Paul's, what we're going to call, theology here. And Hebrew, as a language, is insufficient to the task. Furthermore, in the exile in Babylon, Hebrew has become corrupted into Aramaic, and even more a limited language. And it turns out that Greek is the perfect language for the gospel. It's more versatile, it's richer, it has more flexibility, and it has certain tenses and verbs, different tenses and verbs, like the passive voice, what have you, that the Hebrew language does not have. And so by bringing Alexander the Great into this land during the intertestamental period of time, God was orchestrating bringing the right language into the land that could not only capture, but could promulgate, could communicate the good news.
So how big was the Septuagint then? I mean, that was translated into Greek, the Old Testament into Greek. I think it was about 200 BC, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. The LXX, the 70.
Yeah.
And that is trying to replicate the, I'll call it the historical record and the prophetic record of the Old Testament, but we're also going to need a language here that is going to allow Paul to communicate the theology of what Jesus was all about. Mm-hmm. So it turns out that Greek is the perfect language to do that. But you need more than the perfect language if you're going to promulgate the gospel all throughout the world. If you ever took Sociology 101, which I did, and that did not make me an expert, was the only sociology course I ever took. But I do remember Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that pyramid, if you will. Mm-hmm. And band number one down at the base of the pyramid was called physical security. And unless physical security needs are met, you can never get to a band above it, which is to start to think thoughts about, why am I here? What is life all about? And so God has been at work from, I'd say, almost 400 BC up until the present moment in the gospel period, allowing the Roman Empire to conquer the known world and bring a absence of warfare, which I will call peace. There are different kinds of pieces.
Physical
but the
security
absence
here
of warfare. Mm-hmm. For the very first time in the history of the world was achieved by the Roman Empire. And so God was using the Roman Empire to bring physical peace all throughout the known world so people would at least have some time on their hands to think higher thoughts. Hmm. And then you have to have a distribution system, some mechanism to spread the good news of Jesus Christ and to spread the theology of Paul that explains who Jesus was, what Jesus did, and what Jesus cares about. And starting with the Appian Way, which went basically from around Naples in Italy, north to Rome, was the very first Roman road in roughly 230 BC. That road became the prototype for what became, estimates are, somewhere between 30,000 and 50,000 miles of Roman road put in all throughout the Roman Empire, mostly by the legionnaires when they weren't fighting.
You're going to say that's a staggering amount of labor you can envision going into that.
Oh, amazing. And when you can go walk on those roads today, they're actually still in pretty good shape. I've got some pictures of some paving stones, volcanic rock paving stones that are used. They're 8 inches thick. They fit them together like a jigsaw puzzle. And there is the distribution system that would allow the gospel of Jesus Christ to be quickly spread all throughout the known world. Mm. So while at ground level, it appears that God has not been at work, that God has been silent, that God may well have forgotten his people. The exact opposite was really true. God was at work, setting the stage for the fullness of time for this profound invasion of grace that was going to come through a manger in Bethlehem to ultimately lead to a cross and an empty tomb. And he needed a a distribution system. He needed the perfect language to be carried along that distribution system. And he needed a physical peace in the world to allow that distribution to unfold in an unimpeded manner to people who would finally have time to think something about life other than, will I actually survive tomorrow? And so what's fascinating to me is to, on the front end of Advent, is to reflect upon how God was setting the stage, even though no one knew it. And now, looking through the rearview mirror, we all know it. God was at work. His plan was unfolding in an unimpeded manner, even though Hebrews at ground level in the intertestamental period of time might well have thought, what a mess we're in. How could God let this happen?
Excuse me. You know, what also strikes me is how astounding was the choice of Paul to do this. I mean, who could have been in a better position to do what he was asked to do? A foot in both worlds. He really bridged the two cultures, didn't he?
Well, he had a Greek mind in terms of logic. He had a Hebrew mind in terms of comprehending the scriptures. He had a passionate heart, almost like a Roman, to spread it. He trained under the finest rabbinical system of his day. In terms of setting the pieces, he was yet another perfect piece as God is orchestrating all things to be in place at the right moment in time to enable the fullness of time to further unfold.
Now, that also, all the pieces of the puzzle, actually, Caesar Augustus is another piece of the puzzle, isn't he?
Well, he is, and let's open that one up just a little bit. Caesar Augustus was the great nephew of Julius Caesar. So to understand Augustus, we have to go back a little bit to Caesar.
Yeah, we got to remember that Caesar now is a title.
Well, Julius Caesar.
Well, they're Julius Caesar, but as Caesar Augustus uses it, Caesar is like king or your highness kind of thing.
And there's a reason for that. Mm-hmm. Julius Caesar was an outstanding military tactician. He brought peace to many parts of the Roman Empire. He significantly expanded the territory of the Roman Empire. He was actually quite good at governance. And in the Roman world, down at the eastern end of the Roman Empire, you have those Greeks. And for a long time, Greeks have had this notion that gods, lowercase g gods, could come and would come down to earth and mingle with mere mortals. Hmm. And so this notion of divinity coming to earth originated with the Greeks. It actually predates Christianity. And when Greece entered the Roman Empire, they brought this notion with them of gods becoming man, lowercase g. The Roman culture is a very appropriating culture. They didn't necessarily like all the peoples that they conquered, but they were more than willing to bring in their culture or their gods or their ideas and make them part of the Roman fabric. So if they conquer something in Asia Minor and they find out that in Ephesus there's the goddess Diana, well, fine, we'll bring the goddess Diana into the Roman portfolio of gods. Same with Isis in Egypt. So they were very acquisitive that way, and they adopted, at least the masses tended to, this Greek notion of the gods, deity, coming to earth to be with men or to govern men. And so because Julius Caesar was such a prominent and highly successful, well thought of, esteemed, let's call him a monarch, he was the last monarch of the Roman Empire, that there was this growing movement in the masses that he must be a god as well. Look what he's done. And so out in the masses, there was this projection onto Julius Caesar that he is deity, that he is a god, lowercase g, coming down to earth to govern us mere mortals.
Now, just a point here,
too. To accomplish what he did, he must have been a god.
I'm thinking you mentioned that he was the last monarch. He was the first monarch, wasn't he? Because they were a republic before Julius Caesar.
No, actually, I'm going to make Augustus the first emperor, and I'm going to make Julius Caesar the last monarch, if you will. It's
I
a technical term.
Already.
But when we get to Augustus, that will become a little more clear.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Caesar never viewed himself as deity. He never bought into that notion. He declared himself to be the first of equals. And then he dies. And after his death, I think in response to public opinion, public pressure, the Roman Senate voted Julius Caesar deity status, made him a lowercase god, son of a god. Okay? And this now gives rise to something called the imperial cult, which is our monarchs going forward, from monarchs to emperors, we need to view them in a deity way. And so the worship of the emperor starts to become a state religion. And Augustus, whose original name was Octavian, and Julius Caesar specified in his will that Augustus is to carry on after him. He was his great nephew. Augustus turns out to be an excellent military ruler as well, and he brings the Western end of the Roman Empire, quells some civil wars and some rebellions out there, and for the first time brings peace all throughout the Roman world, which is most of the world at that time. And of course, people are now thinking very highly of him. And since his great uncle was a god, as declared by the Roman Senate, well, it must be that Augustus is a deity as well. You know, it's a lineage kind of thing, heritage kind of thing, legacy kind of thing. Augustus, who was very politically ambitious, never really bought into the notion that he was deity, but he facilitated that notion because it allowed him to achieve his governance goals. And he really began to hijack the democratic principles and some of the democratic forms and mechanisms of the republic that were still somewhat in place during the reign of Julius Caesar. And he converted that thing into a monarchy. That's why we call him the first emperor of the Roman Empire. And having done that, he propagated this notion that he was deity. Once again, the Roman Senate plays into this notion in about 11 BC, after he had conquered the western part of the empire and was consolidating things to bring uniform peace all throughout the Roman world for the first time, the Roman Senate voted to erect an altar to Augustus. And you can see that in Rome today. It was discovered in the 30s when Mussolini was in rising to power. Mussolini had visions akin to those of Augustus, be a great monarch, ruler, empire, emperor. And so he had that altar to Augustus rebuilt, reconstructed. It's now in a very prominent place in a very lovely new building in Rome. And all of this, again, is further backdrop of how God was orchestrating the Roman Empire to set the stage for the birth of his son, who was also going to be from a god, the god, capital G, and was going to come to earth as a man, to be a king, yes, but a king of a new kingdom, an eternal kingdom, the kingdom of God. And so when Paul starts to write about Jesus being the Son of God, that paradigm is already in place with Augustus and with what the Roman Senate had done for Julius Caesar. Without that having been in place, that would have been a pretty difficult notion to get your arms around. But once again, God is at work. orchestrating a very pagan empire to create a paradigmal, a way of thinking, a framework for looking at a worldview that the Romans put in place, that Paul could come along and say, yes, but let me tell you about another God who happens to be the real God who sent his son, who was divine, who, by the way, pre-existed his birth. Augustus and Julius Caesar never pre-existed their birth, okay? And he took those parallels of deity come to earth, raised them up, and put the full and total understanding, let's call it, of the theology of Jesus in place. And an educated Roman of his day said, yeah, I can understand that. We've been thinking those kind of thoughts for a long time. And so it always fascinates me what God was doing in the intertestamental period of time, using the Roman Empire to set the stage for the birth of his son and the spreading of the good news.
Now, the unknown God of Acts 17.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I could just see Paul as he's going through Athens, looking at all these statues of gods, and finds the one to the unknown God, and this big light bulb going on over his head right away. And to think that was a divine moment in his ministry. I mean, that determined what he was going to say, how he was going to approach the subject to those people at the time. Now, I mean, this is really huge.
And once again, Paul, and just to respond to what you just said, looked at the context of the Greek religious system and then adopted that as the springboard to tell them about the one true God. Always on trying to understand the context of the people with which he's writing and speaking. And this backdrop of a deity, lowercase God, coming to earth as was viewed in the life of Julius Caesar and Caesar Augustus was just enormously helpful in paving the intellectual way, the paradigmal way, the worldview way that people could quickly understand and grasp and then embrace that the real Son of the God has come.
And history from 30,000 feet is watching God at work.
And history is his story.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is indeed.
While we were talking, and I remember my own childhood and my interest in Greek mythology and the stories of the ancient Greeks. And it seems to me that there was a time when the ancient Greeks talked about nothing but all the gods hanging around in Mount Olympus. And then there was a point when one of the Greek gods became a man. And I don't remember.
Thinking Prometheus. You know, Prometheus was.
Yeah, maybe it was Prometheus.
The product of mortal and immortal parents.
Yeah, but there was someone that became. That was a god that lowered himself to become a man, and then I don't remember the rest of the story there. But was that part of the paradigm as well?
That I'm not an expert in Greek mythology history, but I'm sure there is an epicenter back in the Greek thought system whereby someone was the first person who came to earth from the gods, and then that created the paradigm that has been extrapolated ever since.
I'd like to suggest that it was Prometheus, and you should take a look at that, because in one aspect, he's a model of Christ. He was the product of immortal and immortal parents, Zeus and the giants, the Titans, I think, was the other half, but they were mortal. He came to earth, brought fire to man, which means knowledge and light, and then he was punished for it. He was tied to a rock, and an eagle attacked him daily because he was immortal. He couldn't die. But he was punished for his act of bringing light, warmth, fire, civilization to man. So kind of the kernel of the Christ story is there. Now, I'm not suggesting at all that was intentional. But it might have been intentional by God, because it's part of that pattern of a God coming to earth. And in this case, bringing something that man needed and then being punished for it. I mean, how reminiscent of the Christ story is that?
Lots of parallels. And to tidy this thought up for today, as we look across our world and we see the rise of Islam, as we see ISIS fundamentalistic, terroristic Islam, as we look at Russia, as we look at Iran, and I could go on and on. I wonder if there are Christians who could say, where is God? Why is he allowing all this to happen? And the only conclusion I want to leave us with here this morning is God is still at work. He is always at work. His plan for this earth continues to unfold in an unimpeded manner, and God continues to set the stage for what is yet to come.
Hmm. And if there's anything I think that David and I have learned from you over the years and from others, is that God's plan will succeed. It proceeds apace, and there's nothing you can do to stop it. It's fruitless to try. And so the only logical choice is to join his team and then watch it all work. It's a miraculous process. And from 30,000 feet, parts of it become readily apparent. Doug, we thank you for that.
Yes,
thanks, guys.
Thank you.
And we'll see you again next Wednesday. Are you available next Wednesday? You're going to be in Louisiana?
I am. Look forward to it.
All right.
Okay.
We will
enjoy your trip
to it as well. Yeah.
Thank you.
Doug Greenwald.
Have a beignet.
Doug Greenwald of Preserving Bible Times. PreservingBibleTimes.org is the website. You can link to them from ours at Broken Road Radio. And you'll see a lot of wonderful photographs, first of all, from his Italy trips. And you'll discover just a great resource of materials that have to do exactly with what Doug was talking about, the context, historic and cultural, of the times of the first century. Doug, we'll see you next week.
Thanks, guys. Shalom.
Shalom, Doug.